Episode 83, The House Begins to Divide. Last episode, we talked about the revolutions in Europe in 1848. The United States is also about to have a revolution. I mean, another one, at least from a certain point of view. From another point of view, it's a rebellion, but we aren't quite there yet. In the Gospel of Matthew in the Bible, Jesus is accused by the Pharisees of driving out demons using the power of Satan himself. And Jesus, in a masterful double entendre, says, "Every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and every city or house divided against itself shall not stand." A house, that is internally divided, will not stand, it will collapse. Jesus' point at the time was that if he was driving out demons by the power of Satan, well, that satanic house would be divided and it would collapse. But he's also making the point that the house of Judaism, the house of the Pharisees, is divided, and many people in Judea had begun to follow Jesus. But the Pharisees had not. The house there was divided. Then, much later, in 1858, Abraham Lincoln, who was running at the time for the U.S. Senate, and quoted Jesus, said in a campaign speech, said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the house to fall, but I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other." Lincoln said that in a campaign speech, and though he did not win that senatorial election, his speech was reprinted all across the North, and it became sort of a rallying cry for abolitionists. Lincoln was talking, of course, about the division between the North and the South, and this division was really about one thing, slavery. The South wanted to preserve the institution of slavery because their social structure and their economy were dependent on it, and the people of the South feared the idea of freeing the slaves and the social, political, and economic consequences that would come of that. And the South wanted the North to not be able to tell them what to do. I think, had it been any other issue at all, it would have been something that could have been worked out over time using normal political procedures. But slavery and states' rights evoked very strong feelings on both sides. The United States itself had been founded as an experiment in self-government. This kind of self-government really hadn't been tried before, not on that large of a scale, and no one knew if it would actually work. A major part of the experiment had been the idea of separation of powers by breaking up the federal government into three branches and keeping most of the sovereignty over laws in the hands of the state governments. The idea had been to set up a central government that could not override the wishes of the inhabitants of any one state against that state's will. So if a state voted to legalize slavery, the federal government should not constitutionally have had the power to override it. This idea of states' rights was one of the founding principles of the United States. It's very clearly built into the U.S. Constitution. And for most political issues, this concept of states' rights worked, and each state was free to make its own laws. But in the case of slavery, it just didn't work. If a man could be considered a slave in the South, but then he escaped and went to the North, where slavery was illegal, I mean literally against the law, as most other northern states had laws that made it a crime to own another person, was that person still a slave? Could his owner come from the South, have him arrested, and brought back to the slave state? That was part of what had happened in the Dred Scott case, and the law wasn't exactly clear. I'll come back to Dred Scott in a minute. People across both the North and the South increasingly began to see that the conflict between slave and free was not something that could be solved by compromise. It was too big of an issue. In the South, the economy of agriculture was completely dependent upon slavery. Slaves did all the planting and harvesting and all the manual labor to keep farms and plantations running. If slavery were outlawed, the southern landowners feared that their farms would fail and the economy would collapse, and it actually did collapse for a few years after the Civil War. The landowners and the non-slaves also feared the idea of giving slaves the status of free men and citizens and the right to vote, because in some southern states, there were more slaves than there were free men. Many in the South viewed the slaves as subhuman and did not think that they deserved the right to vote. There were, however, many people in the South who didn't think this way. But most of the people in the South who were not slaves shared the opinion that they did not want the North nor the federal government to tell them what they could or could not do. They saw this as one of the foundational principles of American government. So there were several very important principles in play: slavery, state sovereignty, national unity, equal justice, human rights, racism, economics. All these things were part of this issue. But at the core, there were two main principles that were in conflict. The principle, on the one hand, that all men are created equal and they're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's clearly in conflict with the principle of state sovereignty, as long as some of the states are practicing slavery. People across the Union began to see that something had to give. The House was beginning to divide against itself. And as Jesus had predicted way back in Matthew 12, and Abraham Lincoln also, a house divided against itself will not be able to stand. Back in 1850, when California entered the Union as a free state, the deal between the North and the South that allowed this to happen was known as the Compromise of 1850. As part of this compromise, Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah were going to be able to choose for themselves if they would enter the Union as slave or free. So this sort of set the precedent for what is about to happen with Nebraska as well. But one other part of the Compromise of 1850 that made it pass Congress was the Fugitive Slave Act, which was passed by both houses of Congress as a way to appease the South about California. We'll come back to the Fugitive Slave Act also in a minute, but first we need to talk about Nebraska. The territory of Nebraska, which was a very large territory at the time, was trying to come into the Union as at least two separate states, Nebraska and Kansas. There was more to the west that would come in as other states later. The north part of the territory is going to become Nebraska, and the south is going to become Kansas. The other parts will become North and South Dakota, and also bits of Montana. There was a Democratic senator from Illinois named Stephen A. Douglas, who in 1854 proposed a bill that would bring Kansas and Nebraska into the Union and would let the people of those territories decide if they were going to be slave or free. This was the same principle that had been proposed for Utah, New Mexico, and Arizona. Stephen A. Douglas's bill was known as the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Now, a quick brief aside on Stephen A. Douglas, who is going to be on and off the stage for a while here. He was not pro-slavery, though he was a Democrat. And he was not really an abolitionist either. He was, like Abraham Lincoln, a lawyer from Illinois, and he's going to be Abraham Lincoln's rival for the next few years. In fact, at one point when they were both living in Illinois, Douglas briefly courted a young woman named Mary Todd, who would eventually go on to get married to Abraham Lincoln and become Mary Todd Lincoln. So yeah, Stephen A. Douglas briefly dated Lincoln's future wife. Now, in a sense, Douglas might have dodged a bullet there, because Mary Todd Lincoln will go sort of insane later on, and she might have even been involved, if not complicit, in her husband's assassination. Looking forward to that episode. But for now, Douglas's Kansas-Nebraska Act proposed that both the new states of Kansas and the new state of Nebraska would choose for themselves if they would be slave or free. Nebraska pretty quickly voted to be a free state, as there were very few slave owners who had settled there. And Kansas, if it had been left to itself, probably would have done the same. But on the day of the vote, about 5,000 men from Missouri, which was a slave state, rode across the border and voted illegally. Now, Democrats are still doing this today, having illegals come across the border to vote. At least they're consistent with their tactics. After the election, the other actual voters of Kansas, the ones who actually lived there, rejected this newly elected legislature, and they began to create their own separate legislature. And that one quickly banned slavery. the two governments began to try to put themselves together and create their own separate militias. In May of 1856, the pro-slavery legislature's militia, plus men who had ridden in from Missouri, marched to Lawrence, Kansas, where the anti-slavery legislature was meeting. The pro-slavery militia drove the anti-slavery government out of town, burned some buildings in Lawrence, and threw a couple of anti-slavery printing presses into the river. Now, this event was widely reported across the North, and people were incensed. There was fighting all across Kansas as pro-slavery and anti-slavery factions fought each other, often using brutal night raids and slash-and-burn tactics. This time earned the nickname Bleeding Kansas. Now, one of the incensed people was an abolitionist named John Brown. John Brown grew up in Hudson, Ohio, in a home that was actually a stop on the Underground Railroad. As Brown grew up, he moved around a good bit, always, though, in places where there was a strong abolitionist movement. He ended up in upstate New York, but by then he had several sons, two of whom later moved to the Kansas Territory. His sons in Kansas were part of the abolitionist movement there. During the ongoing attacks on Kansas from Missouri and other places, Brown's sons asked him to come there to help their cause, so John Brown moved to Kansas in 1855. After the pro-slavery militia attacked Lawrence, Kansas, John Brown led a raiding party that included five of his sons and at least three other people into Pottawatomie Creek, Kansas, and in the night, they raided several houses of pro-slavery families, and they basically just murdered them. At the first house, the house of a pro-slavery guy named James Doyle, they led the family outside in the night at gunpoint. John Brown shot James Doyle with his pistol, and Brown's sons hacked Doyle's sons to death with swords. It was a brutal murder, but they weren't done. They went to four more houses that night and killed most of the men they found in them. Of course, the news of the raid and the murders spread across both the North and the South. Brown himself snuck back out of Kansas and returned to New York. But we will hear from him again pretty soon, in the next episode, in fact. In the meantime, Kansas managed to put together a functional government, and in 1858, it voted to become a free state. It wasn't admitted to the Union then. That didn't happen until 1861, a few weeks after the first seven states had chosen to leave the Union and join the Confederacy, but we're getting ahead of ourselves there. Besides Kansas, one of the other major sources of division between the North and the South was an ex-slave whose name was Dred. Dred Scott was a black man who had been born a slave. He was owned by an army officer from Missouri whose name was John Emerson. John Emerson took Dred Scott with him to a couple of his army postings in Illinois and Wisconsin. Both of those places, Illinois and Wisconsin, were places where slavery was illegal. So technically, while Dred Scott was in Illinois and Wisconsin, he was a free man since there was no slavery allowed in those states. In the early 1840s, both Emerson and Scott moved back to Missouri. Missouri had a legal precedent, though not an official law, that said of slaves that if they had been once free, they were always free. So after Emerson died, Dred Scott and his wife sued Emerson's widow for their freedom. They first had tried to buy their freedom, but she refused, so they went to the courts. Dred Scott's case eventually made it to the U.S. Supreme Court. The court was led by Chief Justice Robert Taney, and he was the one who wrote the majority opinion on this Dred Scott case. It is widely regarded as the very worst judicial decision that the Supreme Court has ever made. Taney argued that Dred Scott had never even been a U.S. citizen, in part because he was black and in part because he was born a slave. So the Supreme Court ruled against Dred Scott's case for freedom, basically ruling on political grounds, rather than on constitutional grounds or legal precedent. It's always bad when the Supreme Court rules this way, trying to make some kind of political statement, rather than just upholding the laws of the land. Like the chaos in Kansas, the Dred Scott case got widespread coverage in both the North and the South. People in the South applauded the government for upholding the institution of slavery, while people in the North protested the obvious injustice of the trial. A northern publisher named Horace Greeley widely published the dissenting opinion of one of the Supreme Court judges, and it became a pamphlet that was very influential in the elections of 1858 and then 1860. Also, it's pretty clear that the dissenting opinion is by far the most rational constitutional of the two opinions. Dred Scott and his wife, for their parts, did eventually get their freedom. Emerson's widow sold them back to the family that they were originally bought from, who soon freed both of them. Dred, himself, died of tuberculosis a year later, but his wife, Harriet, lived to see the end of the Civil War and emancipation, and even the 13th Amendment, which banned slavery forever in the United States. But before we get to all that, we've got a very bloody Civil War that we have to cover. Next episode, we are going to look at the two things that really do end up dividing the House. First, there's the return of our friend John Brown. And second, the election of Abraham Lincoln. Join us next episode as seven states secede from the United States.